Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated September 27th. Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's front cover, Vision Archie, Convergence Center in the middle of RTP's Extreme Makeover, by Lauren K. Onisores, from the Research Triangle Park. Bob Giolis is a man with a dream some might call a pie-in-the-sky fantasy, Research Triangle Park's own Epcot Center. The CEO of Research Triangle Foundation, Giolis is tasked with helming the redesign efforts for the park that houses behemoths such as IBM, Cisco, GlaxoSmithKline, Syngenta, and NetApp, and he has been vocal about his vision for a new and more collaboration-friendly park. Giolis, an unassuming man in a collared shirt and glasses, is thinking far beyond urbanization of the park, with condos and retail, and he is not alone. Community stalwarts, such as Bob Ingram, former head of GSK, Joe DeSimone, a nationally acclaimed scientist, and Smedes York, Raleigh's former mayor, known for his forward-looking leadership, are among the many who have green-lighted the vision. Along with the vision, however, comes the cost of the project, likely to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. But as Giolis explains, the vision drives the money, as it did with the original RTP visionaries who financed the formation of the world-renowned park some 50 years ago. Just last month, the RTF board approved Giolis' plan to proceed with this audacious vision of a global convergence center. Enter Project Archie, codenamed after Archie Davis, who drove the concept of creating RTP more than five decades ago. Giolis wants a symbol, a landmark, to rise over the pines and brand the park in the same way the Sydney Opera House brand Australia's famed harbor. He's looking for a chance at a legacy. Imagine a place, a mix between a Guggenheim, a World's Fair, and the Epcot Center, Giolis says. You'll have something unlike anything anyone is doing in the world today. It's an idea that, according to RTF board member and UNC Chapel Hill researcher DeSimone, materialized shortly after Giolis joined RTF in 2011. Giolis has strong support from our board, and he's in an important position to implement some key directions here, DeSimone says. He gets it. And it could be because he's led high-dollar efforts before. Prior to joining RTF, Giolis served as director of the Clemson University International Center for Automotive Research, which netted nearly $250 million in investment during his tenure. Earlier in his career, Giolis led North Carolina State University's Centennial Campus, which today houses more than 60 companies, including Bandwidth. But Archie might be his most far-reaching fantasy yet. Giolis envisions the center of a campus, not necessarily one building, a part destination, part research facility, and 100% iconic. He sees a place where researchers from universities can work alongside scientists from RTP stalwarts such as GSK and Biogen IDEC. He sees the state's 100 counties using the center as a resource and a tool to develop its own scientific initiatives, from developing compounds and gadgets that create jobs across the Tar Heel State. David Bishop, site lead for GSK and RTF board members, says he too hopes Archie could be something that could help GSK's RTP team collaborate. I'm not sure exactly what it's going to be, physically, from a facilities perspective, he says. And he's not alone. Varied visions exist because, at this point, the center is just a concept. RTP board chair Ingram believes RTP needs a physical identity. If you drive through here, you kind of wonder, where is RTP? Ingram says, we're largely hidden behind these pine trees. We see this as an opportunity. Ingram says a structure should rise above those trees and send a message of innovation, collaboration. A building that could host TEDx speeches and product launches, as well as multidisciplinary labs tackling short-term collaborative projects with global reach. Curtis Fentress, principal of Denver-based Fentress Architects, agrees. A native North Carolinian, Fentress says, RTP can use an image boost to showcase innovation. I think the idea of having something that's more of an iconic image for the park is probably a really good idea in terms of having the image of the Research Triangle Park transcend North Carolina and be known around the world, Fentress adds. But it's an expensive vision. While no one at RTP is willing to make an early estimate on the cost of such a monument, other local structures aiming for icon status have required big cash coffers. Take the $116 million James B. Hunt Jr. Library at NC State, and the $146 million Green Square project, which incorporated a new Nature Research Center in downtown Raleigh. And Ingram is bullish that dollars are out there to fund Geolis' Epcot 2. We don't want to come across as arrogant, but I think we have a lot of confidence that we will be able to put together a very compelling proposal that will attract the size of investment that will make this something North Carolina can be proud of, he says, adding that conversations are already taking place. Both he and Geolis see philanthropic entities along the lines of the Kauffman Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation accounting for the bulk of the cash, though nothing has been pledged in writing as of yet. To be world-class, you need good investors, and we're very, very excited about the response we've already received from both private and public potential investors. For Dishimon, the equation is far simpler. It is about a community's economic relevance in the future. North Carolina can't afford not to build the center, he contends. Geolis envisions his Epcot as a place where researchers from UNC, Duke, NC State, and other institutions can team up to solve far-reaching problems such as solar energy and big data. And DeSimone calls that purpose critical. The expectations in Washington for grants are constantly getting higher and higher, and team science and transdisciplinary approaches are the norm, he says. For Carolina to be successful, Carolina really needs NC State. And for NC State to be successful, NC State really needs Carolina. And there's no mechanism for doing that really well right now. UNC, he notes, doesn't have an engineering program. NC State doesn't have a medical program. And those gaps are rare with universities of their caliber, he points out, adding that the symbiotic relationship between the two institutions makes a center more critical. And just having multiple universities on the grant application makes a difference when the government is divvying up the dollars, he says. Throw in the cooperation of private companies and other RTP institutions such as RTI International, and local grant applications could have sizable bulk. We need this in order for the state of North Carolina to compete and to win, he says. If you don't have this, you're going to see us becoming increasingly challenged in competing for federal dollars in Washington. And I think you'll see us becoming increasingly challenged in starting companies. It's a numbers game, he says, pointing to the top 25 universities getting federal dollars. Currently, UNC ranks 9th on the list, but last among those peers in patents, something DeSimone points to that lack of an engineering program. That's Carolina in the last place in these 25 grouping, and converting those federal research dollars into patents, which leads to company starts, which includes venture capitalists coming in, and that leads to scale up and job creation, he says. We have got to make it easier for our faculty to come together to team so that we can be competitive in Washington for federal research dollars. RTF board member Jack Cecil, president of Asheville-based Biltmore Farms, says Archie is bigger than Duke, NC State, and UNC. There's 15 other state campuses, and there are subject matter experts scattered across the university system, he says, adding that the Archie would be neutral territory for the whole state to utilize. If you could convene all of them together and ask them a question about whatever subject matter, you'd probably have a better response. The Triangle Universities already have a place in RTP in the form of the Triangle University Center for Advanced Studies, Incorporated. TUCESI, it's also known as, and it's a 120-acre campus established in 1975. But TUCESI, Board of Trustees Chair and RTF Board Member Smeed York, President of York Properties, says there's no overlap. TUCESI, which houses organizations such as Networking Technology Nonprofit MCNC and the North Carolina Biotechnology Center in the park, is a physical place, he says. It would complement TUCESI, he says, of the center. The idea of this would be the anchor and key. Complementary, but with a different focus. TUCESI houses institutes such as the National Institute of Statistical Sciences and the National Humanities Center. The Research Triangle Park, its founding universities are NC State, UNC, and Duke, he says. The original idea of the park was to reverse the brain drain, and the idea of the brain drain was in the 50s. Many graduates from those Triangle universities were not able to find work in the Triangle. That was the idea, to create the park so these people could find jobs. Universities have been connected to the park since the beginning. Geolis wants to do these same things, and a little more this time. 70,000 acres and no Starbucks, he says. Maybe that should change. Moving inside the front cover of this week's edition of Triangle Business Journal, we go to Amanda Hoyle's column, which covers commercial and residential real estate. This week's column by Amanda is entitled Crescent on the Rise Again in Triangle. Charlotte's Crescent Communities, once one of the most active real estate developers in the Triangle, has put its Great Recession troubles behind it. Crescent exited Chapter 11 bankruptcy in 2010 with $150 million in exit financing from capital investors and an aggressive reorganization plan. And in the past 2 years, it has committed more than $600 million in capital investment to new multifamily and residential development projects across the Southeast and Texas. That capital commitment includes nearly $150 million for three new apartment communities in Raleigh and in Durham: Crescent Cameron Village, Crescent 9th Street, and Crescent Main Street. While Crescent Community still owns 650 acres in northern Chatham County for its planned The Retreat on Hall River community, it sold its remaining ownership earlier this year at the 600-acre Hidden Lake community in Youngsville, and the 793-acre parks at Meadowview Community in Chatham County. Last week, though, Crescent Communities paid $3 million for 116 acres of land near the Eno River in Hillsboro, where it plans to develop lots for up to 233 new homes. It will be Crescent's first new neighborhood project in the Triangle in several years. We talked to Todd Mansfield, who has served as president and CEO of Crescent Communities since mid-2011, about the company's progress in the past 2 years and its future plans in the Triangle. We are excited to be getting back into development. We had a lot of other land holdings prior to the bankruptcy that we parted with because we wanted to focus on only the best locations in the region. But I think you'll start to see more single-family development happening in the area. Our focus at present has been more in multifamily because that is where the strength of the market was. And when we look at the Triangle as a whole with its employing and population growth, it's really compelling. Mansfield says Crescent is pursuing at least two other Triangle apartment developments, but wouldn't disclose deals or details. Some of the research you see suggests other parts of the country are growing faster than North Carolina, particularly in Texas, where we have a number of projects as well. But the Triangle, to me, has an incredibly diverse economy base that gives me confidence in the ups and downs of economic growth. We do a lot of business in Austin, and I see Raleigh-Durham and Austin in similar light. Both have educated workforce, a diverse, eclectic community, and that is critically important for young knowledge workers when they are choosing where to work. Not every place in the Southeast has that same appeal. Next up, Durham named one of Google's 7 tech hubs. By Lauren K. Onisorge. This is from Durham. Cheers echoed through the colored crepe streamers hung from what used to be a tobacco warehouse Wednesday. In front of dozens of Durham entrepreneurs, Jimmy Goodman from American Underground's parent company, Capital Broadcasting, took the stage announcing local startup initiative American Underground had been picked, along with 6 other cities in North America, to be part of Google's new tech hub network. What can be bigger than you are now having a direct line to Silicon Valley, he asked. The designation comes with money and connections to Google's extensive network of software engineers, but it also brings opportunity, execs say. Mary Grove, Director of Global Entrepreneurship Outreach at Google, says the program will be part of Google for Entrepreneurs, an initiative with 70 different programs reaching 110 countries. It's the first time we've done something cohesive as a network, she says. In addition to regular meetings where leaders at different tech hubs can share ideas, Google is bringing in mentoring and networking events. We're a company powered by entrepreneurs who started in a garage, she says. Culturally, it's something we get really excited about. But it could be more than that. Anil Patel, Director of Corporate Development for Google, in town for the CED Tech Venture Conference September 17th, said a big part of how Google decides on acquisition targets is about relationships. Grove called the network Google's home base for reaching out to the startup spaces, which could mean the network is a way for Google to identify and foster acquisition targets. Grove couldn't say specifically, but she did say that Durham will also be able to use the program to connect to other tech hubs identified by Google, such as Minneapolis and Chicago, and that could lead to partnerships and exits. Michael Goodman, Vice President of Real Estate at Capital Broadcasting Company, is already looking to American Underground's next expansion. It's all part of the formula, trying to create physical virtual density, Goodman says of the partnership. Earlier this year, American Underground opened an additional hub in downtown Durham and announced plans for a third space, this time in downtown Raleigh. There's no timeline and no specific location yet, but he's confident the network will continue to build, and some of that building could take place on Google's dime. Part of the partnership involves a financial infusion to its new tech hubs. Grove won't be specific about the dollar amount going to the Goodman team, but she says it's a fairly significant portion that would help underwrite costs for events and things throughout our partnership. Anil Chawla, founder of American Underground startup Archive Social, says he's still unclear of the details, but is excited. The fact that the access to Google exists makes me really optimistic, he says. Rhonda Klosner of Research Triangle Park-based incubator First Flight Venture Center says good news for American Tobacco is good news for all of the Triangle's entrepreneur endeavors. We all play together, she says. Above all, the players agree the move means validation for what the American Tobacco and Durham have been doing for the past 3 years. And that, Jim Goodman says, is taking the area from tobacco to technology. Next up, Jason DeBruin's column. Jason covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. This week's column is entitled UNC Healthcare Tackles Turnover and Incentive Pay. UNC Healthcare recently released its annual report, and there were a few interesting data points for the past fiscal year, which ended June 30th. Chief Operating Officer Dr. Brian Goldstein and I chatted about a few of those topics via email. Here are a few tidbits from that conversation. After nearly 40% increase in health and incentive pay from 2010 to 2011, UNC Healthcare paid out fewer total incentive checks in 2012. More people were eligible, but total payouts decreased from $11 million to $10.1 million. In looking at the numbers, however, Goldstein says, I don't believe there are any meaningful trends here. Year-to-year variances are the result of several variables, Goldstein says. That, of course, includes both the formula itself and actual performance in meeting goals. The total number of eligible employees for that fiscal year also play a factor. The individual performance targets are for finance, patient satisfaction, employee satisfaction, quality, safety, and innovation. The incentives are paid on an all-or-nothing basis, with employees receiving the incentive pay only if the hospital, as a whole, meets its target. If the targets are met, then every employee receives a bonus. If the target isn't met, all employees receive nothing. After years of mostly declining employee turnover, UNC Healthcare saw an uptick last year to 9.3% from 7.72% the year before. Here again, Goldstein says it's too early to tell if the increase represents a trend. He points out that the rate is pretty close to the rate of 2010 and 2011, and surmises that the low mark might actually be an outlier. Since healthcare employment has been growing locally and nationally, we believe that a flat turnover rate generally means we are doing pretty well with employee loyalty, he says. Another theory is that this shows a small rebound in the overall economy, meaning there is more employee mobility. This is even more true at an academic medical facility where workers or spouses are completing residency training or other schooling. In our case, a fair number of our employees have a significant other who is in graduate school or in residency training, so we always lose some people when the significant other graduates and gets a job elsewhere, Goldstein says. UNC Healthcare is exempt from the State Personnel Act. A side note, UNC Healthcare sector jobs growth trails in the U.S. rate. Since the beginning of 2008, healthcare job growth in the United States as a whole has outpaced job growth in North Carolina. With December of 2007 as a baseline, North Carolina's healthcare sector has increased its workforce by about 4% and is actually showing a bit of slowdown since the beginning of 2013. Conversely, the U.S. healthcare sector has demonstrated more of a hockey stick-shaped growth curve, hitting a nearly 10% growth rate. UNC's Dr. Brian Goldstein says he would predict that the national numbers are more likely to show the same dip as North Carolina rather than the other way around. Given the changes and uncertainties with healthcare reimbursement, I expect such a drop in healthcare net job growth for the next few years, he says. I don't know why the NC healthcare market has consistently seen slower job growth over the past few years. My only speculation is that our relatively high statewide unemployment rate has meant fewer people with employee-based health insurance and therefore fewer people with insurance coverage overall. Next up, observers weigh in on RTP's vision. By Lauren K. Onisorge. From the Research Triangle Park. Research Triangle Foundation board member Smee York sees the benefit of an iconic building that redefines the image of the research park and the triangle. When you say iconic, it's something that. When you think of the park, you'll think of this. And when you think of this, you'll think of the park, he says. But not everyone is on board with the idea of an aesthetic icon. Larry Wheeler, executive director for the North Carolina Museum of Art, is on the design committee for RTP's redesign. He also helped bring a convoy of worldwide architects to the park in May, and their consensus differs from Geolis's Epcot Dreams. That group says, okay, let's just not forge ahead and do this crazy new center. Why don't you think more of what it will represent? How things will be done in more sensible, relevant ways, Wheeler recalls. A lot of the architects were advocating doing something that's flexible, something that's sustainable, that's lower key. It doesn't have to be some sort of international architectural statement. But an international statement is exactly what Geolis, Bob Ingram, and York say they're looking for, and Wheeler says he's not going to get in the way of that. But he does suspect the traveling Geolis has been doing to recruit economic development and RTP is influencing the vision. He's looking at all of these various projects, he notes. I think he sees he wants to build something that becomes a statement of the new RTP, and the whole new ethos around the research centers, something that gives the park a new life and a new distinction. All of these great things, but how that comes together architecturally, I think, is unresolved. Architecture historian and NC State University professor Burak Erdin says that even well-intentioned icons become dated, including one of Geolis's inspiration, the Guggenheim. Sure, it attracted a lot of people for a while, but time will tell how people continue to use that space, he says, adding that it's the other side of Giolis's vision that could create the legacy. The social life of the monument or the icon, that's the lasting or sustainable value of the imagery of the building, not the particular way that it looks. Taiwook Cha, principal architect at New York-based Supermass Studio and part of the summer convoy Wheeler arranged to visit RTP, said he couldn't comment on the active project he's involved in, but he did offer his thoughts on Giolis's Guggenheim Epcot World's Fair's fantasy. Those are the places that envisioned innovative new ways of living, working, or cultivating people's lives, he says. I believe it is those ideas, the idea of innovative thinking behind each of the projects, that RTP is interested in, rather than the architecture. Giolis isn't the only one who has a pie-in-the-sky goal for Research Triangle Park. In the 1950s, Archie Davis, chairman of what was then Wachovia Bank, teamed up with other leaders to turn worn-out farmland into an industrial park to help turn then-struggling North Carolina around. The result of that? The Research Triangle Park. And now, why Archie? Because it's warm and honorable. By Amanda Jones Hoyle, from the Research Triangle Park. The leaders at Research Triangle Park have been capitalizing on the name Archie quite a bit in the last few months, with the RTP Archie Summit held last July, and now they're incorporating the Archie name into the proposed Global Convergence Center. But who is Archie? The proposed center's name, according to RTP President and CEO Bob Giolis, is in honor of one of the key founders of Research Triangle Park, Archibald K. Davis, a Winston-Salem banker who was known across the state as simply Archie. Archie Davis was recruited by former Wachovia President Robert Haynes and Governor Luther Hodges in 1958 to help raise the initial $1.25 million needed to purchase the first pieces of land for Research Triangle Park and to build the park's first research building. As legend goes, Davis traveled across the state in his little white car meeting with business and community leaders face-to-face to garner pledges for the good of the state. Davis succeeded in his mission and actually raised $1.42 million from about 850 donors. According to historian Albert Link's book, A Generosity of Spirit, The Early History of the Research Triangle Park. Davis also later helped raise $2.6 million for construction of the National Humanities Center building and RTP. About a quarter of the funds from RTP's original capital campaign came from business leaders in Davis's hometown of Winston-Salem, where he also built a 42-year banking career at Wachovia Bank. Davis served as chairman of the bank from 1956 until his retirement in 1974. It was also Davis who proposed that both Research Triangle Park and Research Triangle Institute, predecessor to RTI International, both operate as nonprofits. According to historical interviews with Davis, he knew that if the Research Triangle was to be designed for public service rather than for private gain, it would be easier to raise money from corporations and institutions that were more interested in doing a service for the state. In 1959, he was chosen as the first president of the Research Triangle Foundation of North Carolina, a position he held until 1981. He also served as chairman of the foundation from 1978 to 1987. In addition to his work at RTP, Davis served two terms as a state senator from 1958 to 1962. One term as president of the American Bankers Association in 1966 and 2 years as president of the United States Chamber of Commerce from 1971 to 72. Following his retirement from Wachovia, he enrolled in UNC Chapel Hill to earn a master's degree in history and even published a book about the Civil War. Archie Davis died in 1998 at the age of 87. What follows is a brief timeline of some of the major milestones for the RTP date back to the summer day in 1956 with the start of the land assemblage. 1956. Governor Luther Hodges and Wachovia President Robert Haynes formed the Research Triangle Committee Incorporated and Pineland Incorporated a stock venture company is created to assemble the land needed for RTP. 1959, Archie Davis raises $1.4 million needed to acquire the first 4,400 acres for Research Triangle Park and for construction of a building for its first official company, the Research Triangle Institute. 1965, IBM announces it will locate a 400-acre, 600,000-square-foot research facility in the park, and the U.S. government decides to locate its new $70 million National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Center. 1971, pharmaceutical firm Burroughs Wellcome, now GlaxoSmithKline, relocates its U.S. headquarters from Tuckahoe, New York, to RTP. 1988, Gertrude E. Leon and George Hitchings, researchers with Burroughs Wellcome, received Nobel Prize in Medicine. 1994, Martin Rodbell of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences campus in RTP receives the Nobel Prize in Medicine. 2012, RTP Foundation presents new master plan for Research Triangle Park. And in 2013, RTP announces Archie Initiative to strengthen its state, national, and international footprint and create an iconic focal point for the park. Next up, Carrboro Native keeps a variety of expansion ideas on tap. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Carrboro. Long before Tyler Huntington even thought about opening his own bar and restaurant, he was driving across California and the western U.S. with a full sketchbook, looking for a job. But Huntington wasn't sketching the rocky cliffs along the Pacific or the Sonoma Valley vineyards. He was sketching the layout of a beer brewery building or taking notes on a bar setup and decor. Sometimes he would write down the whole menu list or swipe a copy if it didn't look too expensive. All those notes would come in handy years later when he did open his own bar and restaurant, Tyler's Tap Room on Main Street in his hometown of Carrboro, and later when he and his partners opened three more Tyler's Tap Rooms in Durham, Apex, and Raleigh. Now Huntington is going back to the drawing board with an even crazier idea. He wants to build a micro distillery for the production of his own line of whiskey, rum, and possibly gin, called Revival Spirits Distillery, to be in the same building where he plans to start a new catering business and event facility. "We have a lot of hoops to jump through still," he says, "but we hope this will be a revival of traditions," he says. Huntington and his partners paid $660,000 in July for a former R.J. Reynolds warehouse next to the old Durham Athletic Park that they plan to begin renovating this fall. The 14,000-square-foot facility was built in the 1930s, but Huntington sees the same potential in the building at 609 Foster Street as when he first toured the American Tobacco campus before the first redevelopment building had even opened. Tyler's was the second retailer to open at the campus, but the first restaurant to commit to a lease. "The minute I walked into this building, I loved the place," he says. "It's got that really cool old Durham warehouse feel with enormous windows overlooking the old Durham Athletic Park." Huntington also plans to build an 1,800-square-foot covered patio deck on the back of the building for larger event parties. The long-term goal for the distillery, though, Huntington says, is to one day grow his own wheat and barley on his wife's family's farmland near Danville, Virginia. "All the way from crop to glass," he says, "but it's kind of hard to do that and run the restaurants right now." And business at Tyler's Tap Room, he says, has been busy at all four locations lately. Huntington wants to open the catering kitchen first, he says, because none of his restaurant kitchens can currently handle the extra load. Altogether, his restaurants and bottle shops are bringing in between $12 million and $16 million annually and employ 300 people. Other than 2008 and 2009, when sales were mostly flat, Huntington says that Tyler's bottom line has grown every year at each location. "I talk to a lot of Keenan Flagler and Fuqua School of Business students who come through here wanting to talk to me, and the number one thing I tell them is to be realistic. Don't do like I did," he said. Huntington says when he opened the first Tyler's Taproom restaurant and bar in 1998 in an old pool hall in Carrboro, He just wanted to build a bar to hang out in, one that carried craft beers that he couldn't find anywhere else in the region. And he hoped other people would want to hang out at his bar, too. I did everything you're not supposed to do. I maxed out my credit cards, and I went to get new ones. I got a loan from the town and a $45,000 loan from the bank using my house as collateral. I built all the booths and the tables. But he also had to survive on only tips that first year, abiding by his first creed. Pay your employees first. Without them, he says, your place isn't going to make it. Tyler's Tap Room is also one of the few local restaurant groups that has been offering employees health insurance for several years already. I've been fortunate that I've accidentally become surrounded by really good people, he says, and that is the most critical element in why we've been able to grow. Continuing on, this week's column of family business is by Mr. James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and is a family business speaker, author, and advisor. This week's column is entitled Balancing the Needs of Insiders and Outsiders. A frequent source of trouble in family-owned companies is friction between family insiders and family outsiders. The insiders are those family members inside the business. They are executives, managers, and employees, often but not always with some ownership stake in the company. They're compensated by the company and may enjoy perks along with any profit distributions that their stock entities entitle them to. In some cases, the family insiders don't work in the business but are inside the senior owner's immediate family circle. The outsiders may be shareholders, not working in the business but participating in profit distributions according to the company policy or the dictates of the insiders. They may be spouses, parents, or children of shareholders, or relatives outside the immediate family circle. Some outsiders are actually on the inside, family members employed by the business who aren't among the decision makers. The differences between insiders and outsiders are often the source of the outsider's jealousy or the insider's suspicion of the outsider's motives. Family members are blinded to one another's perspectives, priorities, and concerns. When it should be the focus of pride and satisfaction, the business is instead a firewall that keeps people apart who should be pulling together. In my 20-plus years of advising family businesses, I've run into several common causes and effects of insider-outsider friction. The most common cause is the misleading or misunderstanding of roles, responsibilities, and realities on both sides. The outsiders complain that their stock dividends are too small. The insiders complain that the outsiders are clueless about the real cost of running a business successfully. The outsiders call for more management transparency. The insiders call for more gratitude and support. In other cases, the outsiders have limited access to the company's financial or organizational information or can't really use the information that's available. The problem might lie in the company's lack of a system for disseminating information in an understandable form to those with a right and need to know. Or maybe there's no forum for reasonable questions to be asked and answered. Insiders who spend most of their days and many nights managing the business for the benefit of the whole family feel harassed and unappreciated by the outsiders. "Hey, what do you want from me?" an insider might ask. "I'm not sure," might be the reply, "but I'll know it when I see it." Sometimes the fault lies in poor management of the company or other family interests, including insider hoarding of ownership benefits. The outsiders have a justifiable complaint when the insiders stonewall their inquiries in order to shield questionable business practices. "But where does all the money go?" the outsider might ask. "I'm busy running the company," might be the reply. So don't bother me with your whining. Many business-owning families just can't figure out the reasons for their persistent discontent. The insiders work hard but take little satisfaction from their efforts because of a vague feeling that someone's looking over their shoulder. Outsiders wonder what's really going on in the business and worry that they're not getting their fair share of ownership benefits. Families that have figured it out have addressed the problem by overhauling their internal system for keeping family members in the loop. The insiders issue quarterly performance memos and answer the phone when outsiders call with questions. "This is what we're doing," they say, "this is why we're doing it, and here are the results." Insiders and outsiders meet at least once a year to review the business's status, its achievements, and its challenges, and to enjoy one another's company. Unless it's recognized and dealt with directly in honesty, friction between family members inside and outside the business can escalate into open, ongoing conflict. Relationships fall victim to constant nitpicking and digging for flaws and mistakes. Planning and management decision-making are paralyzed as the family's attention is focused on the fight. In the worst cases, the voices of reason, respect, and family affection are drowned out by shouts of, "I'll see you in court." It takes a bit of effort to open up the family business to the family and to calm the friction between those inside the business and those outside. But it's worth it. And now, the physicians' groups. Varied specialties dot the Triangle scene. The Triangle has been known for a long time for its highly respected collection of hospitals, but the area is also home to a plethora of varied physician groups. These groups can be hospital-owned or independently operated, and there are a host of both kinds represented in the Triangle. Physician groups employ hundreds of doctors in the area. These physicians specialize in a variety of subsets, including emergency medicine, cardiovascular services, obstetrics, orthopedics, and pediatrics. These groups perform a number of services, including orthopedic surgery, neurosurgery, nuclear and interventional cardiology, diagnostic imaging, and general family practice functions. Several of the groups in the Triangle, such as Wake Radiology and Triangle Orthopedic Associates, have been treating patients here for more than 50 years. And here's a look at more of the represented specialties among this year's list of physician groups and a few facts about each. First, radiology. Interesting facts from applied radiology. The use of advanced visualization originally emerged as a method for streamlining the analysis of large data sets from advanced imaging scanners in radiology departments. Today, AV has evolved from 3D applications commonly found on the modality workstations to 3D-specific workstations and now to enterprise advanced 3D imaging solutions that can be accessed from anywhere. Next up, orthopedics. Interesting facts from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. According to the latest survey by the AAOS of its members, the state of Wyoming has the highest density of orthopedic surgeons per 100,000 people. The state with the lowest density is Mississippi. The national density of orthopedic surgeons is 8.72 per 100,000 people. Next, cardiology. Interesting fact from the American Heart Association. Uncontrolled high blood pressure can injure or kill you. Possible health consequences that can happen over time when high blood pressure is left untreated include damage to the heart and coronary arteries, stroke, kidney damage, vision loss, and erectile dysfunction. And lastly, oncology. Interesting facts from the American Cancer Society. About 1,660,290 new cancer cases are expected to be diagnosed in 2013. And in 2013, about 580,350 Americans are projected to die of cancer, almost 1,600 people a day. Cancer remains the second most common cause of death in the U.S., accounting for nearly one of every four deaths. This week's guest opinion column is from Mr. Michael DiCastello. Mr. DiCastello is Upstart Business Journal's Technology and Innovation Editor. His column is entitled, "Is Your Mobile App Kids Compliant?" On September 19th, Apple launched its new Kids App Store category, curated by Apple editors for children 11 years old and younger. It's not easy building products for children, and for anyone considering getting into the business, knowing Apple's compliance rules is a good first step, not just for kids' sakes, but for that of developers, too. Developers who wish to see their work featured in the new section marketed specifically to kids will need to follow the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, also known as COPPA. According to the Act passed for 1998, it is illegal for the operator of a website or online service to knowingly collect or transmit personal information from children under the age of 13 without a parent's consent. Operators that do collect information about children with a parent's consent must protect the confidentiality, security, and integrity of the information. It is illegal to condition a child's participation in a game by offering a prize. The new Kids App category now also requires developers to have clear privacy policies. Apps can't use ads that ask kids to complete certain in-app activities, and children have to ask for parents' permission before linking outside the app for commercial purposes, according to a TechCrunch report. Not only are 13-year-olds playing with and learning from apps, they are building them too. In November 2011, middle school students at Max Kolber and Max Dillabelle founded the Minnow App Academy to teach boys and girls between the ages of 9 and 18 how to build apps. According to a Business News Factor report published recently, the duo is hoping to win a $250,000 grant to help them teach more app builders. Fortunately, the two boys are now 14 years old, so Apple won't have to worry about making an exception to their policy. Next up, the Triangle Business Journal's This Week guest column, which is written by Mr. John Hood, who is the president of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. His column is entitled, Washington's Raleigh's Move to Bend Healthcare Cost Curve. Although it may not seem obvious at first, there is a common denominator between two separate dramas playing out in Washington and Raleigh right now. Nationally, the top story in domestic policy is the impending implementation of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. In North Carolina, controversies within the state Department of Health and Human Services are dominating state news headlines. In both cases, officials say they are trying to rein in health care costs. At the federal level, the Obama administration promised that its 2010 reform bill would bend the cost curve of health care downward, saving taxpayers thousands of dollars a year when fully implemented. At the state level, the McCrory administration is developing a reform strategy to use competitive contracting and other means to limit cost inflation in North Carolina's medical program, or in Medicaid program, currently the most expensive in the South. The two reform agendas differ substantially, of course, although managed, competition is a shared design feature. I won't pretend to lack an opinion about their respective virtues. As Duke University's Chris Conover pointed out in a Forbes column, the idea that Obamacare would reduce the cost of health care over time is deeply at odds with reality. Total spending on U.S. health care will rise, not fall, as Obamacare is implemented. As for the McCrory administration's thinking for Medicaid reform, I think it is promising, but the details have yet to emerge, and the departure of Medicaid Director Carol Stickle to a private sector job in Florida is at least likely to delay the strategy's implementation. Let's set aside the merits of the two contrasting reform plans for a moment, however, and consider why it's important to rein in health care costs in the first place. As societies mature and economies grow more sophisticated, it is entirely reasonable for the share of total economic output devoted to health spending to rise. Technological innovation and economies of scale, among other factors, allow people to satisfy their immediate needs for food, clothing, and shelter at a decreasing unit cost. That leaves them a growing share of their incomes to devote to other goods, and particularly to services, including health care. This is just basic math. All subcategories of household spending, including savings to fund future spending, must add up to 100% of the income in the long run. So far, so good. But health care is not exempt from the law of diminishing marginal utility. Initial spending on clearly valuable medical services alleviates tremendous human suffering and death. As we continue to spend more on health care, however, the next increment of personal benefit tends to be smaller than the previous one. It is possible to spend a great deal of time and resources on medical care that doesn't really save or improve lives much. Either because the treatments had a low probability for success, think heroic efforts to save terminal patients, or because we spend many preventative healthcare dollars on people with a low probability of getting sick in the first place. If resources were unlimited, it would be meaningless to speak of spending too much on healthcare, particularly since we would all reside in heaven and have better things to speak about. Here on planet Earth, however, resources are inherently limited. To the extent that households, businesses, or governments spend ever-increasing sums on health care that doesn't produce similarly increasing benefits, we can't spend money on other goods and services that might make us safer, happier, and more productive. Specifically, excessive spending on health care pushes up federal income and payroll taxes, which discourage private investment in new companies, employees, and capital goods. At the state level, excessive spending on health care via Medicaid and other programs displaces additional private investment via higher taxes, while displacing greater public investment in assets such as roads and schools. While we may continue to disagree about how best to discourage excessive health care spending, surely we can all agree that addressing the issue is critical to rejuvenating America's economy and improving our quality of life. Here are a few quick glances of things happening across the triangle. STEM courses. Students from Wake North Carolina State University STEM Early College High School got a glimpse of some real-life applications for concepts they are learning in the classroom. Representatives from Lord Corporation set up 8 stations just outside the school's building on the old Dorothea Dix campus and showed students that science and math can actually turn into a fun career. "We want to show the students that engineering can be fun," says Suzanne Killam, the career development coordinator for the school. "By having employees from Lord come over, it gives them something that sticks," she says. Lord Corporation participated as part of National Aerospace Week. "This is our way to promote science and math," says Scott Miller, a marketing manager for Lord Corp. Also, taking it to the streets and the hallways. Citrix's new downtown Raleigh facility may have something in common with New York City streets, says ShareFile founder Jesse Lipson. While rooms at the current office are named based on Raleigh neighborhoods, Lipson says something more innovative is in the works for the new building. "We're trying to figure out an even more intuitive way of naming conference rooms and other common areas in the building so that it's fun and interesting, but the name also helps you figure out where in the building a particular conference room might be," he says. "Kind of like in New York, how if you know that something is on the corner of 57th and 8th Avenue, you basically know how to get there." Citrix's new facility is being constructed in the Warehouse District in downtown Raleigh, and Citrix made the decision after acquiring Raleigh-based ShareFile. Also, there's curb appeal with the State Employees Credit Union using native species. Raleigh-based State Employees Credit Union is partnering with the North Carolina Botanical Gardens and design firm O'Brien Atkins to install landscaping for its branches using North Carolina native plants. The idea was sprouted by State Employee Credit Union member Tom Earnhardt of WUNC-TV's Exploring North Carolina. Earnhardt says, "It's always seemed strange to me that some businesses and even towns often plant the same non-native tree over and over. Kudos to State Employees Credit Union for showcasing native trees, shrubs, and flowers found in the regions where its branches are located." Also, there's a changing of the guard at Pulte Group. When Triangle Business Journal's list of the largest home builders in the Triangle came out last week, we noticed one significant change among the leadership of the number one building company in the region, Pulte Group. Sometime over the summer, Pulte Group brought in David Carrier as its new Raleigh Division President. Carrier replaces Lawrence Lane, who we later found out is no longer employed by Pulte. Lane had been with the company for 9 years, serving the last 3 years as its Raleigh division president. Carrier has been with Pulte since 2001 and was previously a vice president of finance for Pulte's East Area, based in Washington, D.C. He's also worked at the company's offices in Detroit, Chicago, and Denver. Here's a side note about ETIX. CEO Joe Kostelski describes the goals of ETIX in simple terms. If Ticketmaster has 95% of the online ticketing business, he's happy to shoot for the other 5%. The RTP-based company on TBJ's Fast 50 list for 2013 got in on the ground floor of digital ticket management in 2000 and has enjoyed a decade of steady growth. The company handles regional venues such as Cary's Cocobooth Amphitheater and the NC State Fair, but it also has the muscle to handle ticketing for national customers such as Boston's Fenway Park. Its reach extends throughout North America and 40 countries worldwide. Finally, Triangle Business Journal was told about a pretty big honor for local business exec Grace Ewing, who was chosen as one of 8 Asian American women of influence by Audrey magazine. Audrey is a national magazine that covers the business and personal lives of Asian American women. In the article, Ewing says, "I wasn't the super geek who codes, but because I went to MIT, I really understood technical people." After her stint at MIT, Ewing went to Harvard Business School. Today, she runs her own marketing company, Savvy Marketing Group, and calls herself a corporate therapist. Along with Ewing, MSNBC anchor Alex Wagner also was named in the magazine's inaugural Women of Influence feature. Triangle Business Journal has worked with Ewing for the better part of the past decade on various local business initiatives and joins Audrey in congratulating Ewing for this recognition. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.